Welcome to God and Country Biblical Exposition. Looks like the midterm elections were not the Republican red wave that the conservatives were hoping for. I'm not surprised, as the last days come upon us. The majority of the voting public believes in humanism, that man's moral freedom is the basis for ethics rather than the law of God. So they vote for their abortion, their transgenderism, their socialism. Conservative, moral, and economic values are considered uncool, stodgy, oppressive by the spirit of this age. This is the lawlessness of the last days. Lawlessness will increase, Matthew 24:12. These things must need take place in order that the world may be judged. But don't be discouraged. When you see all of these things take place, lift up your eyes, for your redemption draws near. Luke 21:28. On this week's program, I'd like to talk about Christless conservatism, which is a fitting topic because it explains why conservatism keeps losing political ground in our nation. Because without the message of Christ and genuine repentance, conservatism cannot change the culture. What made America great in the first place, and what made the West great in the first place, was religious revivals, personal conversion to Christ. Now, if you clicked on this video because you want to hear a critique of Jordan Peterson's conservative manifesto, you're going to have to wait till the end. I was originally going to do the entire program critiquing the manifesto, but it's more needful for me to lay a biblical foundation before I get to Peterson's treatise. I mean, once you have a biblical foundation, you'll be able to soundly critique Peterson's manifesto yourself. So let's get started. Christless conservatism is that brand of conservatism that promotes laws, principles, and values that align with the Bible, but leave off Christ and the gospel. And this makes up just about all of the conservative movement today. All of the conservative news networks, the periodicals, the websites, the pundits, the YouTubers overwhelmingly preach a conservatism that leaves off any direct reference to Christ in the gospel. The punditry is merely about how conservatism is a better, more honest way to live. Now, in this Christless conservatism, there is often an underlying belief in God, in God's moral absolutes. In fact, it's difficult to be a conservative without a belief in God, because the basis for conservatism is that there are absolute moral laws given by the Creator. Those on the political left, the liberals as they're called, build their ideological foundation on moral relativism, that right and wrong are a function of what pleases man. Man is king, not God. But conservatism is generally based upon theism. The title conservatism has been adopted because these people want to conserve the values of the past. And a verse that comes to mind is Jeremiah chapter 6, verse 16. Thus saith the Lord, stand by the ways and see and ask for the ancient paths, where the good way is, and walk in it, and you will find rest for your souls. But they said, we will not walk in it. The ancient paths for Israel at this time would be the faith of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the Mosaic Covenant. The title progressives is given to the political left. They want to abandon the moral values and the policies of the past. They want to progress. Now, of course, in the early New Testament church, the title conservative would not apply to the Christians because they weren't trying to conserve the paganism of ancient Rome. But given the fact that we've had at least 1,500 years of Christian moral values built up in the West, we have something to conserve in law and culture. Now, granted, there are many who are conservatives out of mere custom, tradition, even superstition. Plenty of people do the right thing, but for the wrong reasons. But conservatism has its original foundation of belief in the higher law of God. Now, there's a whole scale of how theistic or how attached to biblical law any given conservative might be. Some conservatives are just conservative economically and practically, but not completely morally, like Joe Rogan or David Rubin. Some conservatives are slipping slowly toward leftism as they're being more influenced by the culture than the scriptures. And some conservatives are conservatives economically and morally and have a strong biblical faith, like Senator Ted Cruz or Mike Pompeo or Ben Carson or Jay Sekulow or Mike Huckabee. And if you follow political thought, you'll soon discover how weak or strong any given social leader is in their conservative views. And I hope you realize that the conservative movement in America is typical of what happens when a country is on the road to Sodom and Gomorrah. There will always be some common sense people who know pragmatically that economically and morally, lawlessness results in disaster. The bad results of a sinful lifestyle, the prodigal lifestyle, is pretty obvious. But their pragmatic concerns are never enough to save a country. Remember the famous quote of John Adams? "We have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion. Avarice, ambition, revenge, or gallantry would break the strongest cords of our Constitution as a whale goes through a net. Our Constitution is designed only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate for any other." The law, the Constitution, is not adequate to keep people straight. Now, by religion, John Adams was referring to the supernatural power of Christian conversion. So that defines conservatism. But again, what I want to address in this program is this issue of Christless conservatism, conservatism that leaves off the person and work of Christ and the gospel message. And there are a host of reasons for this. Many in the conservative camp are totally clueless concerning the gospel. So, of course, they can't address the gospel solution. Other conservatives may be very much Christian, but they leave off the gospel because they want to appeal to a wider audience. They may also believe that moral principles are sufficient. They're merely laying the groundwork, and they're going to leave it to the clergy to bring in the gospel. Besides, you'll never get elected to high office, or you'll never get a large media platform if you start talking about salvation through Christ. So this may be, for some conservatives who stay silent, a way to avoid the offense of Christ. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 8. "Christ is a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense." 1 Corinthians 1:23, "But we preach Christ crucified, to the Jews a stumbling block, and to Gentiles foolishness." And in Galatians chapter 5 and 6, the Apostle Paul speaks about those who want to be religious and theistic, but avoid the offense of Christ. The Apostle Paul would have been hailed a great teacher in the Roman Empire if he simply went from city to city teaching morality, virtue, good governance. There were many actual conservatives in ancient Rome who preached virtue, and they were very popular. But in that Paul preached Christ, Acts chapter 20, verse 23, Paul writes, "Imprisonment and afflictions await me in every city. Such is the offense of salvation through Christ's atoning work on the cross," what is called the preaching of the cross. But remember what Jesus said, Luke chapter 7, verse 23, "Blessed is he who does not take offense at me." Here's my thesis. Christless conservatism will not save America. It might actually make things worse. And I believe I have the backing of the Bible on this. And hopefully we'll have time to look at some texts in this regard. But here is the confusion or the quandary. Christless conservatism seems to be so helpful. You have commentators like Tucker Carlson, who do a great job in informing the public concerning the dysfunctions of government, the dysfunctions of the ideological left. These conservatives uphold moral values, even though they don't proclaim eternal salvation through Christ, which is by far our greatest need. But these conservative pundits at least seem to keep the non-Christians in line. They may even lay the foundation for coming to Christ later, in the sense that Paul even said that the law is our tutor to lead us to Christ, Galatians 3:24. And in Romans 7, Paul writes this, "What shall we say then? Is the law sin? May it never be. On the contrary, I would not have come to know sin except through the law, for I would not have known about coveting if the law had not said, 'You shall not covet.' I would not have come to know about the evils of our nation, the evils in myself, and my false beliefs, if it weren't for these conservative pundits." So maybe these pundits, in addressing the right way to live and the right way for the state to govern, are like the law. Romans chapter 3, through the law comes the knowledge of sin. But can the preaching of the law alone save? Can it change the sinful bent in man? No. The knowledge of sin doesn't give the power, the ability, or the desire to leave sin. We read in the book of Hebrews chapter 7, verse 19, one of my favorite verses, "For the law makes nothing perfect. On the other hand, there is the bringing in of a better hope through which we draw near to God. That better hope is the promise of the new covenant, the transformation of the soul, the new birth, regeneration, conversion, the indwelling of the Holy Spirit." As C.S. Lewis wrote in Mere Christianity, that Christ did not come with new methods or new laws. He came to make new men. First, we must have a new man. Then the laws of virtue will be effective. God's solution to sin is to change our nature through a supernatural encounter with the living Christ. Book 4, chapter 10 of Mere Christianity is entitled "Nice People or New Men." Lewis writes, "Mere improvement is not redemption. Though redemption always improves people, even here and now, and will in the end improve them to a degree we cannot yet imagine, God became man to turn creatures into sons, not simply to produce better men of the old kind, but to produce a new kind of man. It's not like teaching a horse to jump better and better, but like turning a horse into a winged creature." Well, that's the radical message of the gospel. John chapter 3, verse 3. "Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a man is born again, he will not see the kingdom of God." That's a message most people don't understand, both liberals and conservatives. And we have something greater than conservative values. In fact, conservatism has been tried in the past, and it's failed. So imagine a country where the law of God finally reigns supreme, where all the people are taught the moral law of God, and they're given proof beyond a shadow of a doubt that God exists and has a moral law. Well, that happened at Sinai with the Hebrew people. And the people broke the law and turned back to paganism and idolatry before the ink was dry in the Ten Commandments. Or should I say, before the chiseling was done. Moses prophesied in Deuteronomy chapter 31, verse 29, "For I know that after my death, you will act corruptly and turn from the way which I have commanded you. And evil will befall you in the latter days, for you will do that which is evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger with the works of your hands." Why? Because the people were corrupt in their very nature. And why was that? Because the people weren't converted or changed by the Holy Spirit. Deuteronomy chapter 29, verse 4, Moses says, "Yet to this day the Lord has not given you a heart to know, nor eyes to see, nor ears to hear." What needed to take place for these people to truly obey the law of God and true holiness was a transformation in their soul. As Moses also prophesied in Deuteronomy 30, verse 6, Moreover, the Lord your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your descendants to love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, so that you may live. People need a heart or a soul transplant. As the prophet Ezekiel also foretold concerning the coming salvation of the new covenant, Ezekiel chapter 36, verse 26, God says, "Moreover, I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit within you, and I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes, and you will be careful to observe my ordinances." But as it was, the principles and the teaching of the law didn't restrain the sinful nature of the people. The heart of man naturally goes after immorality and leftism. Well, certainly this is on a scale. I mean, some people still have the common sense and the conscience to hold on to a certain amount of morality. But even those moral conservatives don't have true or complete holiness within their soul. So can the law save, convert, or transform the sinner's nature? Well, that's the issue that's addressed in the book of Romans, and that's the issue underlying this problem we have with Christless conservatism. In Romans chapter 2, Paul addresses the powerlessness of the moral conservative, the unsaved moralist. In the first three chapters of the book of Romans, Paul discusses the guilt of all mankind, and he divides people into three categories. First, the immoral pagan. Chapter 1, verses 18 through 32. These are the people God gave over to degrading passions, to the lust of their flesh. The second group are the moral pagans, chapter 2, verses 1 through 16. And the third group, the religious Jew, or rather, all those who are religious or theistic. And the big surprise is that all three groups fail to measure up to God's standards. They're all lost. None is righteous, not even one. There's none who understands. There's none who seek for God. None are in a state of purity. But it's this moral pagan we want to consider here. Chapter 2, verse 1. In ancient Rome, there were the Stoics who believed in living disciplined lives. They didn't follow their passions, but believed that there was a moral law of nature that should be followed. These were the moralists, the ethicists, the conservatives, morally, economically, socially, politically. There were Romans who believed in hard work, who believed in personal responsibility, that it wasn't right to freeload off of the state. One must provide his own way. And these people believed in the importance of family. There were even Romans who spoke against the foolishness of idolatry. Now, even though Rome eventually became debauched, there were Romans who were moral conservatives. That's what originally made the Roman Empire great in the first place. And these highly disciplined people exist in every society and in every age. You know, maybe the result of their upbringing, maybe the result of their love for power and money. It takes a disciplined life to be successful. It may be a result of their pride. They pride themselves in the self-control they have that other people don't have. It also may be the result of their intelligence. They realize that immorality and drunkenness get you nowhere. So they may not be truly righteous. They just might be practical. And again, there's always those people who are orderly and disciplined in mind. They're always the good kids in the class. They get their affirmation and their praise by going along with the rules. And then they're the bad kids in the class. They get their affirmation by breaking the rules and in the pleasures of life. That way they can get their ego needs met since they're not like the smart rule-keeping kids. So in the Roman Empire in the first century, there were the Epicureans and the hedonists in Rome who believed in living for pleasure. And they lived immoral lives and they justified it with their philosophies. But there were many in Rome who held to the philosophy of Stoicism, founded in 300 BC by a philosopher by the name of Zeno. And Zeno taught that living a virtuous life is the way to happiness, and it will involve suffering. But virtue has a greater reward than living simply for pleasure, like the Epicureans. Stoicism was the conservative utilitarianism of the first century. That honesty and morality are the best policy. It'll give you a better life. So don't give in to your anger, your envy, your lust, your jealousy, your greed, because it's self-destructive. Kind of like following the good side of the force. And in Paul's day, there was a very famous Stoic philosopher by the name of Seneca. He was a great advocate of conservative Roman morality. He was very popular. He was the Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, Ron DeSantis, Jordan Peterson of the first century, all rolled up into one. The early Christians even admired him. The early church father, Tertullian, called him our Seneca. In other words, the Christians identified with him. But what does Paul write concerning these conservative moralists, those who can judge right from wrong? We know in chapter 2, verse 1, that Paul has switched subjects to address these moralists in Rome because he's addressing those who pass judgment on the first group, the hedonists, the immoral. Romans chapter 2, verse 1, therefore, you have no excuse, every one of you who passes judgment, for in that which you judge another, you condemn yourself. For you who judge practice the same thing. So how are we to understand this? Were these conservative moralists committing the same sins as the hedonistic left? Were they no better than others, giving no more hope to the Roman Empire than the immoral pagans? I'm sure the immediate response from these moralists would be, that's nonsense, Paul. I don't do the same things as these homosexuals, these pedophiles, these murderers described in chapter 1. What are you talking about, Paul, claiming that I do the same thing? In fact, Paul's statement in chapter 2, verse 1, not only offends people, but it's a statement many people would philosophically argue against. Because if Paul is claiming there is no moral distinction between people, then isn't Paul undermining all morals? So what is Paul saying when he writes, you do the same thing? Is Paul saying these moralists have the same potential to do the same sins? Or is Paul saying that these moralists do some of the same sins? Or is Paul saying that they do the same type of sins, but to a different degree? Paul really doesn't explain what he means. Because I believe Paul does not have to explain. We all know it's true. Just like Jesus in John chapter 8 with the woman caught in adultery. Jesus said, he who is without sin among you, let him be the first to throw a stone at her. And when they heard this, they all began to leave one by one. There is not one sin in the list in Romans chapter 1 verses 29 through 31 that the moral person has not committed to some degree or another. Romans 1:29. Being filled with all unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, envy, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice, their gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, without understanding, untrustworthy, unloving, unmerciful. There's not a single person who has not experienced some greed, some envy, some malice, or has never lied or gossiped, or has never been unloving at some point. Now, if you say, well, I've never committed immorality, well, Jesus cleared that up in Matthew chapter 5, verse 28, that whoever looks upon a woman to lust after her has committed adultery in his heart. Even without carrying out the act, the twisted desire is still latent in the human heart. Any inner fantasy, even if it's just a passing thought, should frighten us immensely because it shows the potential of evil within us. And given the right circumstances, the right provocation, we would all fall. Corrupt inner thoughts condemn us as having a corrupt nature. The seed of sin is within us, and all vices exist in all men. Even though it may be suppressed for a little while by social pressure or by conscience, Even if we have some good thoughts, the evil thoughts are still there. So the hearts of both groups, the immoral people and the moral people, are basically the same. The unsaved moralists of the world might talk the talk, but they cannot walk the walk. Bill Bennett, who wrote that great children's book of virtue, come to find out he had a gambling addiction problem. Newt Gingrich, who criticized President Clinton's immorality, he himself had an affair and left his wife. Rush Limbaugh went through three wives. Sean Hannity just left his wife, and he seems to be with a younger news reporter. The point is, the law doesn't save, nor does it make people righteous in practice. Telling young people just say no to drugs hasn't stopped the drug problem. It's only gotten worse. So now let's talk about Pelagius, the British monk in the 5th century. Pelagius opposed salvation by grace taught by the great theologian Augustine. And this was around AD 350 to 450. Pelagius objected to many biblical truths regarding salvation because to him, those truths did not seem fair or logical. He refused to believe in original sin, that Adam's sinful nature was passed down to his children. He denied that the human nature is corrupt. He believed that men are able to keep the law of God, because God would not have required mankind to keep a law if they were not actually able to keep that law. And he denied salvation by grace, given as a gift, because Pelagius believed man had to choose and work to save himself. Any aid from God would be unfair. That would violate free will. And grace would mean God would be affecting our salvation. And Pelagius believed it had to be up to man. And if it's up to man, man has to have the ability to do good and be good on his own. The ability to choose righteousness. And here is a very significant statement from Pelagius. I want us to think about this. He said the assistance of God consists only in instruction. Another way this was said, the knowledge of the law is God's means of promoting virtue. In other words, Pelagius taught that merely the teaching of the law is enough to motivate, inspire, and empower people to do the law. And that contradicts everything we read in the New Testament about the inability of the law to save us and our need for personal regeneration. Romans 3:20, by the works of the law, no flesh will be justified, for through the law comes the knowledge of sin. 2 Corinthians 3:9, the law was the ministry of death and condemnation. Hebrews 7:18, for on the one hand, there's the setting aside of the former commandment because of its weakness and uselessness. Hebrews 7:19, the law makes nothing perfect. And in Romans chapter 7, verse 10, Paul writes, "And this commandment, which was to result in life, proved to result in death for me." Despite what Pelagius taught, the law does not convey virtue. It only reveals sin. But the doctrine of Pelagius is exactly what many conservatives are teaching: man's ability and salvation by the law. And if you leave off the person and work of Jesus Christ, by default, you're implying that people just need to pick themselves up by their own bootstraps and obey the law, or rather the principles of virtue. By the way, Pelagius is considered the father of modern liberalism in that he denied man's sinful nature and attributed sin to the environment, and in that he taught that man can save himself. And that's the foundation of modern liberalism, leftism. So it's no wonder that Christless conservatives eventually move in the direction of liberalism. Because if you preach morality without Christ, eventually you'll no longer preach morality. Let me give you an example of what I'm referring to in regard to Christless conservatism. I was in the car the other day listening to a very popular conservative commentator. And he was interviewing a conservative guest who happened to have a new book out. And he asked this guest, "How did this moral decline, this wokeism in America all begin?" And the writer explained that it started in the universities. The Marxist radicals in the universities in the 1960s couldn't sell their Marxism to the general public, so they retreated into the universities, and there they taught Marxism and its philosophical foundations to the next generation of Americans. And that's true. But I find that almost all conservatives are never willing or able to go any deeper. Like, why were there Marxists in the first place? And why did the students and the faculty favor Marxism and reject a traditional American theology and values? So when this man was asked, what's the solution? This writer said democracy. Return to freedom. Freedom of ideas and thought. And there are many crisis conservatives who are teaching that the solution to America's woes is a return to freedom. As if the reason for leftism is merely because the left has cornered the market on education and the media, that they have monopoly power, and it was all simply a matter of the left having better propaganda, better marketing techniques, better infiltration into the universities. And we've heard this premise many times in many different forms, that freedom alone will bring virtue. That if ideas are given an equal playing field, then the right ideas will win. Because if people are given all the information, they're going to take the right path. And the assumption is the goodness of man. And if there are any problems with humanity, it's simply an informational problem. Like Plato wrote in his Republic, that all we need for a great nation is to have wise rulers, philosopher kings. But does freedom, a level playing field of ideas, really bring about virtue? Like Pelagius taught, that the knowledge of the law itself will promote virtue. Well, no, freedom of ideas cannot produce virtue in men because men by default are dead in their trespasses and in their sins. Ephesians chapter 2. So I hope when we hear conservative commentators spouting off Christless conservatism, a Christless solution to national woes, when they're in effect teaching Pelagianism, or they're like the Judaizers who believe the solution is to be educated in the law, I hope we can immediately identify it as the error that it is. The gospel of Jesus Christ is a radically new message. Salvation or perfection by the law, it sounds so good, but it's powerless. It's not the gospel of Christ. Now, don't misunderstand, the law is good. As Paul writes to Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 1, the law is good, but only if someone uses it lawfully. That is, the conversion of the soul must first be preached. That must be communicated in any teaching about the law or about virtues or good governance. Otherwise, all you have is salvation by the law. One final example of Christless conservatism is Jordan Peterson, the popular, generally conservative psychology professor from Canada. He recently put forth what he is calling the Conservative Manifesto. And Peterson begins by stating, a profound crisis of meaning currently afflicts, destabilizes, and demoralizes the sovereign citizens of the West. A crisis of meaning is referring to the meaning of life, the source of values, or the absence of a transcendent purpose for life. And the solution Peterson puts forth is a return to eternal truths or values. And he lists those values and then gives a short explanation for each: humility, liberty, autonomy, truth, agency, identity, merit, responsibility, tradition, community, stewardship, justice, and unity. Humility versus prideful authoritarian arrogance. That will help us to understand the opinions of others. Liberty enables people to think authentically, to choose from a diversity of opinions. Autonomy This is the idea that people are autonomous and not controlled by the state. They will find appropriate solutions. The free market can produce virtuous outcomes. Truth, and here Jordan says, truth itself is never to be found in a particular set of facts or body of knowledge, but truth is found by man's own discourse. And I'm sure you see the problem there. What about man's inability to arrive at truth apart from divine revelation? Agency is about the sovereignty and the personal responsibility of the individual. Identity is about the sovereignty of the individual over the group identity, the identity politics of the left. Liberty is about enabling people to think authentically without arbitrary constraints. And we need to teach merit. People need to reap the consequences of their actions and responsibility. People require a purpose to offset the tragedy of life. People need something of true value. So you get the point. I'm certainly not doing any justice to Peterson's explanations. I mean, if you have a free 40 minutes, you can watch the whole piece on YouTube. So his vision is this. If the West can just get back to those values, we can save the West, quote, from the corrosive doubt and ignorance that has taken over the Western world. Peterson does believe in absolute values, even from a theistic point of view. These values are not just accidents of evolution. And Peterson honors the Bible, although he sees it more as values couched in mythology, but that we need to take heed to those ancient values nevertheless. And Peterson believes in human corruption. Notice this interview that Peterson had with Piers Morgan, where Peterson's position on human depravity surprises Morgan. And I love this piece.
Well, he's a lot more like everybody else than anyone thinks. You know, the notion that he's Hitler or Stalin, that's just foolish. I don't see any evidence for that at all. I mean, first of all, Hitler and Stalin were very singular types, and there's a bit of Hitler and Stalin in everyone. So, you know, there's some truth in that. Maybe there's more in the typical Russian leader than
normal. A bit of Hitler in everyone? Really?
There's more than a bit.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, well, why would have Nazism spread the way it did? You know, people think, well, that's all top down. It's not top down. There's a part of people that are all these people who informed on Kate Berbelsing.
Well, didn't Goebbels say that the way to get vast numbers of people to go along with what you want to do is to terrify them?
You can hold a
grip of terror over them.
Oh, yeah, but...
And then, in a way, that's what Putin's now doing with the Russian people, where he's going back now into a position of they're all trying to get us, they want to attack us, they want to take us over. He's terrifying his people to rally support for what at the moment is a conflict he has started, which is not going the way he assumed.
Well, the most... what would you say? The wisest commentators on totalitarian states, like Solzhenitsyn, and many psychological commentators, Jung was a good example of that, made a very straightforward case that you can't have a totalitarian state unless every single person is willing to lie about everything all the time. And you can think about that as top down because the leaders lie too. Mm. And they also enforce punishments if you don't lie. But then you can also think about it. The totalitarian spirit is replicated at every level of the society. And so in a truly totalitarian state, husbands lie to their wives and parents lie to their children. And the totalitarian state is actually the grip of the lie. And so, and people will certainly go along with that. I mean,
Morgan is surprised by Peterson's evaluation because Morgan is a leftist and he believes that man is basically good. So notice Morgan tries to explain the corruption of German people as being caused simply by the propaganda of the elite leadership. But Peterson's explanation is right on. There's more than just a little bit of Hitler in each one of us. But Peterson in his manifesto doesn't understand the gospel cure. He's very similar to the Stoics in ancient Rome. Zeno, Seneca. That we ought to live moral lives because it's a better way to live, it's more fruitful, it's more healthful. It's more genuine. It's the teaching of morality, the teaching of the law, without an understanding for the need for supernatural conversion for a relationship with Christ. in order for people to be truly good and to be changed. Now, I understand why people like Peterson hold back from receiving the gospel. And let me just explain two reasons. First, they consider themselves to be good and wise, and that seems to have been achieved without any kind of religious experience. So they assume that that will work for everyone else. But are they truly good? They also must be saved from their own pride and arrogance and sin. Second, these intellectuals are reluctant to receive any truth from outside themselves. They're suspicious of revelation that claims to be from God. So instead, they resort to their own logic and their own experience. And it's good that people are suspicious. Suspicious of unauthenticated authority, we want people to be suspicious. But eventually, one has to admit our limitations. That we need revelation from outside of ourselves to show us the way to God. Information has to come from God. And that humbles our pride that we have to accept a truth from outside of ourselves, but that's the whole point. Hebrews chapter 1, verse 1. God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. And the discerning and the receiving of this truth from God is by supernatural faith. The willing soul will recognize the voice of God. John chapter 10, verse 27, my sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. You cannot put that in a test tube and academically describe it. Closing story. Back in the 1980s, when I was starting a church in Princeton, New Jersey, or outside of Princeton, I was doing some door-to-door evangelism. And I knocked on the door of a professor of science at Princeton University who told me that he recently came to faith in Christ. I asked him how it happened, and I expected him to share all the historic, apologetic, theological, and logical reasons why he came to Christ. But instead, he simply said he visited a church, he heard the gospel, he realized in his spirit that it was true, his eyes were opened, and he received Christ. And at that door, I learned more than in many of my seminary classes. If you don't know Christ and the gospel message, my prayer is that your eyes will be opened. Thanks for listening. Like, subscribe, share, leave a comment below, and may Jesus Christ reign.